Yesterday we reviewed the history of philosophy very quickly up to the start of the 19th century, and we noted that coming into the 19th century, the Enlightenment assumption that man can gain certainty through his reasoning ability had been somewhat shattered by the skepticism of David Hume, and then it had been chastened by Immanuel Kant's restriction of what we can know rationally to the realm of appearances, things as they seem to us, and we cannot know ultimate reality, things as they really are in and of themselves. There were three different strategies for dealing with this loss of certainty in trying to restore it that the 19th century will come to be characterized by. We've only begun to look at the first one, and that is to revive reason in a more sophisticated form. Rather than the naive Enlightenment reason of, say, a Locke or even a Descartes, Hegel suggested that if we would refurbish reason so that it was more adequate to the character of reality, that we'd be able to gain certainty again. The second strategy that I told you we'd be looking at was to restrict reason to its proper functions, or what were taken to be its proper functions, and that is basically natural science and our experience of the physical cosmos. The third strategy will be to disregard reason. If it's not adequate, who cares? To disregard it in favor of an alternative access to the ultimate truth about reality. And it's strategies 1 and 3 that we hope to look at in our lectures today. I'm going to finish, Lord willing, our discussion of Hegel, and then we'll turn to the first major alternative strategy for being in touch with ultimate reality, and that'll be the philosophy of Schopenhauer. Okay, just a word or two of review about Hegel. Remember we said that the starting point for Hegel is his conviction that the universe is rational. The real is the rational, and the rational is the real. This is the is of identity. And if the universe is rational, then the disagreements that are out there must be able to be resolved and resolved objectively. Hegel said every particular assertion that is made is only a partial truth. Every particular assertion is made from a limited perspective and is one-sided. But every assertion has some truth in it. I mean, even a lie can be seen to have some truth in it because it tells you something about the nature of the liar and what interests him or her. I noted that for Hegel, which is going to be hard for American students at the end of the 20th century to appreciate because we don't think this way, but for Hegel and for many of his contemporaries, minds and their objects are functionally related to each other. They're not independent. It's not like you have minds out there and then they encounter objects in the world and they know those objects. That's a very naive view, according to Hegel and to other idealists. Rather, the subject of knowing, the mind, is affected by its objects, and the way the objects appear is going to be affected by the activity of the mind. And so they're really in something of a dynamic relationship. They affect one another. I didn't give you this sentence yesterday in the lecture, but as I was reviewing, I got to thinking maybe this would help you, especially if you understand the philosophy of Kant. For Hegel, the ideas of reason, when we're reasoning, the ideas that we use are not merely regulative. Not merely regulative. This is what Kant had said. Kant said the mind imposes these ideas on our sensations and so regulates the way we think. But rather, the ideas of reason are constitutive. That is, the way reality is constituted by the activity of the mind in dealing with it. For Kant, time and space, remember, are constituted by the mind thinking temporally and spatially. There, it's not just a matter of regulative ideas, but it's more that reality itself can't be other than and is constituted by the mind thinking in this way. However, for Hegel, these ideas of reason that are constitutive of reality and not merely regulative of our thinking are constitutive not of phenomena. That's what Kant would have said. The mind makes this chaotic sensation that's coming in phenomena, makes it intelligible, but it's only the appearance, the way we must think. Hegel said it's not just phenomena, as Kant said, that is constituted, but noumena, the way things really are constituted by the thinking of the mind. It's pretty wild. You stop and think about it. It's a pretty grand claim. At least, I mean, I don't agree with Kant, as you know, if you took my course, but you can go a little ways with Kant. You can understand how he might suggest that the ideas of reason regulate or constitute the way things appear to us. But for Hegel, the mind's interaction with objects constitutes the way they really are, constitutes a noumena. But anyway, that's just another way of explaining minds and their objects functionally relate to one another. They're not independent of each other. We saw next that for Hegel, the thinking of the world in general, the corporate spirit, and the thinking of individual minds is developmental. And there's a parallel between the thinking of individual mind as it develops into greater and greater self-consciousness and the thinking of the big mind, if you will. That's not the precise way of putting it, but it'll help you, which is also developmental. And then toward the end of class yesterday, we talked about the need for concrete universals. I'm assured that some of you were at that point ready to fall off altogether. So I'll review just a bit on that. Concrete universals is the problem of what categories or ideas should we use to understand our experience. If your categories are too broad, then your thinking is going to be over simple, isn't it? It's going to be simplistic, as we say. And I use the illustration of Dr. Bonson's looking at the color swatches in a hardware store or paint store and realizing, oh, my thinking that colors are like blue and red and green has been too oversimple. The world is much more detailed than that. And Hegel was concerned that the concepts, also called universals, that men use in their reasoning can be oversimple, too broad, too abstract. Well, the opposite of being abstract is being concrete. Rather than being too general, the more detail that you pack into your thinking, the more concrete it becomes and more adequate it becomes. However, if you go all the way in terms of being concrete and you just have your feely, touchy approach to the world and you don't even think in terms of concepts, then that won't work either. And so Hegel said, what we need is a universal, like the rationalists say, but it's got to be a universal that's adequate to the details of the world as we experience, as the empiricists say. We need a concrete universal. A concrete universal isn't arbitrary and imposed from outside. It develops from the content of thought itself and reflects the uniqueness of thought and the uniqueness of the objects of thought that thinking is about. Now we're going to continue the lecture today in the new point, and this I don't think you'll have too much trouble understanding, although sadly one of our textbook authors did, and that is Hegel held that there's a need for the universal, unqualified truth. We've already said that every assertion that we make is a partial truth and therefore is always qualified. But Hegel believed that as the mind develops into greater self-consciousness, what we need, we may not have it right now, but what we need is unqualified, universal, total truth. So I'll put that up here on the board here, the need for universal, unqualified truth. And to say this is another way of pointing to the monism of absolute spirit in Hegel's philosophy. The unity, the monism, the oneness of what he called absolute spirit. At the end of yesterday's lectures, I said, given the assumptions in Hegel's thinking that we have traversed already, I've tried to explain certain steps along the way, given what we've said about Hegel, even in our review this morning, it's going to be impossible to arrive at the truth by examining the situation in which we live as of some particular time. The truth cannot be qualified by just some particular time. The truth that we have, if we're going to be concrete and rational about it, the concrete truth can only be seen, properly seen, in a historical and a genetic context. Every truth, remember, is the result of this dialectical process. And so to understand something correctly, you have to understand its history, its development, its genesis, if you will. Every truth, every finite truth that we deal with, you know, whether it's about who won the World Series or, you know, what will cure malaria or some specific truth about the human race, every finite truth that we consider is only one stage in the evolutionary development of the total truth. That evolutionary development is one of conflict and discrepancy and then correction. All right, so yesterday I said, this wall is white. And that's a partial truth. That's true as far as it goes. But if you really wanted to understand that truth, you'd have to go back and see what developed it in terms of its outworking, but also that truth has within it the seed of its own destruction, as Hegel put it. The seed of its own destruction, because any assertion you make, given its one-sidedness, is going to generate a compensating truth, its negation. And then the negation helps you to correct what you said, make it more adequate, more concrete, and more universal at the same time. And therefore, for Hegel, thinking or consciousness, thinking advances toward the truth by way of negation. The concept of negation is crucial if you're going to understand the Hegelian dialectic. Every partial truth negatives itself. That is, it calls forth its negation because it's one-sided, it's partial. But that negation is not to be seen as something adverse or bad. To our way of thinking, in my finite consciousness, if I assert something and somebody comes along and contradicts it, I take that as bad. I see my kind of old-fashioned, archaic, enlightenment approach to reason. I tend to think, oh, negation stands over against me, that's bad. But Hegel said, no, embrace the negation, because the negation helps you to become more precise, more concrete, and therefore more adequate in your thinking. And so these are limited analogies and illustrations, I know, but we can sympathize, even from a Christian perspective, with this, it seems to me. If I'm preaching, let's say I go to a youth retreat or to a men's retreat, and I'm preaching, and in my preaching, I say something about how men have, you know, really lost their godly character, as the Bible gives it to us. We've been feminized in this age and subordinated, and leadership qualities are lacking in Christian men these days, and so forth. Maybe I'm saying something which is true. Many people think that there's something to that generalization. But if I were to express myself that way, somebody could come up to me afterwards and say, you know, I can understand why you put it the way you did. But, you know, when you talked about how men are not being the kind of men God wants them to be in the late 20th century, it's also true that women are not trying to be the kind of women God wants them to be in the late 20th century. So what you said was one-sided. The real truth is that men and women both have lost their proper roles and understanding of what God wants of them in the late 20th century. Now, do you all follow that illustration? There's a case where I was saying something true as far as it goes, and the negation, here's the person now constructively criticizing my sermon or my Bible lesson, the negation is something that doesn't stand over against me that I should worry about. It helps me to become more full and accurate in what I am saying. Okay, so if you get that, that's, in a sense, Hegel's attitude toward negation. Every partial truth generates its negation, but that's good, because that means we're moving toward a greater precision and adequacy in what we think. This constant process of negation and resolution takes away any fixed or stable character to the objects of our thought, however. And it's not as though we have these truths that now are, if you will, engraved in stone and you never have to change them. No, our truths are always having to be refined, and that means the way we think about the world is refined, so the objects in the world are constantly being changed as well. You may want to get this quote in your notes because it's classic Hegel. This point about negation is expressed by saying, every thought carries the process of its own dissolution within itself. One more time. Every thought carries the process of its own dissolution within itself. On the board here, I'll just write down the word negation to capture what we've been talking about. As the process of self-consciousness coming to the universal, unqualified truth, negation is what is the engine that moves it along. Every partial truth dissolves, it generates its own negation. Now, we've talked about this already, so I'm not going to take a lot of time reviewing, but this is what we call dialectical reasoning. You have the dialectic, the dialogue leading to resolution, the dialectic between a thesis, its antithesis, and then a synthesis that is more adequate and can take the truth of both and get rid of what's false and partial or misleading in both at the same time. Now, I'm going to depart, well, not altogether departing from Hegel, but I have to talk about Francis Schaeffer for a minute or two here. Not only for the sake of getting Hegel right, but also because you're reading Schaeffer. What I'm going to be saying about Francis Schaeffer is said very constructively and sympathetically, but Schaeffer tended to so oversimplify Hegel when he presented him that it almost amounts to a misrepresentation. The amazing thing to me and to many others who have respect for the ministry of Dr. Schaeffer or Mr. Schaeffer is that he could get the details wrong on certain points of art or philosophers like Hegel, and yet if you stand back and look at his commentary on the flow of culture, he got it right. Okay, so I wouldn't be assigning you Francis Schaeffer if I didn't think there was value in that book. But I wouldn't be responsible as a teacher if I didn't correct it when I thought there was especially egregious error. And I think Schaeffer has misportrayed this notion of dialectic, where every truth has its negation within it. And so I have to say a word about this. Now, for the advanced students, if you're being reflective about this, the irony in my correcting Schaeffer is I'm really being Hegelian about this, aren't I? Because what I'm saying is, well, Schaeffer has said some things about Hegel, but they're very imprecise and misleading. And so now what I want to do is give you a more adequate understanding of Hegel by using the Hegelian method on Schaeffer. If you didn't understand what I was just saying, just laugh and go on. It's okay. Okay. Now, to look at Schaeffer for a moment here, in How Should We Then Live, and in his other books as well, Schaeffer tells us that the major turning point for modern man, that philosophical development that led him below the line of despair, any despair of gaining a unified field of knowledge, was the advent of Hegelian philosophy. And so Schaeffer says in The God Who Is There, it was the German philosopher Hegel who became the first man to open the door into the line of despair. And in his book, He Is There and Is Not Silent, Schaeffer says, and I quote, before this, in epistemology, man always thought in terms of antithesis. That is the first step in classical logic. In antithesis, if this is true, then its opposite is not true. And then in The God Who Is There, Schaeffer says, before Hegel's time, truth was conceived of on the basis of antithesis. Truth in the sense of antithesis is related to the idea of cause and effect. Cause and effect produces a chain reaction which goes on in a horizontal line. With the coming of Hegel, all this changed. Hegel proposed, from now on, let us think in this way. Instead of thinking in terms of cause and effect, what we really have is a thesis, an opposite is an antithesis, and the answer to their relationship is not in the horizontal movement of cause and effect, but the answer is always synthesis. Thus, instead of antithesis, we have, as modern man's approach to truth, synthesis. Well, this whole cause-effect stuff has nothing to do with Hegel. I don't know how that got in there. Schaeffer goes on in the book, He Is There and Is Not Silent. Hegel argued that antithesis has never turned out well on a rationalistic basis, so he proposed to change the methodology of epistemology. Instead of dealing with antithesis, let us deal with synthesis. So he set up his famous triangle. Everything is a thesis, it sets up an antithesis, and the answer is always a synthesis. He thus changed the whole theory of how we know. And then in his book, Escape from Reason, Schaeffer says, what did Hegel say? He argued that attempts had been made for thousands of years to find an answer on the basis of antithesis, and they had not come to anything. Philosophic, humanistic thought had tried to hang on to rationalism, rationality, and a unified field of knowledge, and it had not succeeded. Thus, he said, we must try a new suggestion. He changed the rules of the game in two areas, epistemology, the theory of knowledge, and the limits and validity of knowledge, and methodology, the method by which we approach the question of truth and knowing. What he said was this, let us no longer think in terms of antithesis, let us rather think in terms of thesis, antithesis, with the answer always being synthesis. And then he comments that a choice was made, and the choice consisted in holding on to rationalism at the expense of rationality. These are the crucial words, at the expense of rationality. And then in your textbook, How Should We Then Live, Schaeffer contends, and I quote, non-Christian philosophers from the time of the Greeks until just before our modern period took reason seriously. They accepted the validity of reason, that the mind thinks in terms of antithesis, in terms of the first lessons of classical logic. A is A is not not A. But then, says Schaeffer, there came a shift in philosophy toward romanticism and with it a pessimism regarding rationality. This shift was the responsibility of Rousseau and Kant, Hegel and Kierkegaard. And it created, according to Schaeffer, the characteristic mark of modern man that the lower realm of reason is taken to lead invariably to despair and is totally separated from the upper realm of values, meaning, and optimism. When Schaeffer addresses Hegel's role in your textbook in this development, he says, "The dialectical unfolding of history, whereby successively new syntheses are formed through the perception that there is truth in both thesis and antithesis, is what Hegel is known for." And that leads Schaeffer to conclude that although it's an oversimplification of Hegel's complete position, the result is that all possible particular positions are indeed relativized, and this has led to the idea that truth is to be sought in synthesis rather than antithesis. That is to say, we've given up rationality, and this whole thing on synthesis relativizes everything. But remember, right now what we're looking at in our lecture is the need for universal, unqualified truth. That's Hegel's point. And so Schaeffer, you see, I happen to disagree with Hegel too, but Schaeffer doesn't appreciate that all this discussion of dialectic is for the sake of saving the rationality of the truth as unqualified rather than relativizing everything. Jay? Well, just the traditional laws of thought in classical logic, that A is A, the law of identity. A is not not A. Okay, so, yes, and he's saying, Schaeffer's saying Hegel threw out antithesis and with it rationality and relativized everything in terms of his advocacy of synthesis. Well, the word antithesis is not really what's at stake here. But it is the case that what Schaeffer portrays Hegel as doing is not true to Hegel's intention. And that's why I feel an obligation to correct it here. I think he's misconstrued the philosophy of Hegel and presents a view of what Hegel was doing and the results of what Hegel wanted to do in a way that Hegel never would have recognized. He never would have condoned this. And that's always a good test of whether we're being fair to people. This is a rule of life, but it's a rule of Christian scholarship, or any adequate scholarship as well, that when you represent your opponent's position, when you state it, he ought to be able to hear it and say, "Yes, that's what I believe." Okay. The tendency for all of us, even the person who is now, you know, giving you this little chiding lesson, the tendency for all of us, if we're not careful, is to portray our opponent's position in the worst possible light, because that makes it easy, you know, to destroy it. We need to portray our opponents in a way that they would affirm as, "Yes, that's what I believe." And all I'm saying here is, I don't think, if Hegel read what Schaeffer said about Hegel, he'd say, "Who's this guy talking about? That's not me. I'm not trying to relativize the truth by means of synthesis. My whole endorsement of dialectical logic, the use of synthesis, is in order to what? Get at the absolute unqualified truth." You see, Hegel saw this thesis-antithesis dialectic as a necessary step in the inevitable achieving of utter rationality. And so Schaeffer, I think, has gotten it wrong when he sees Hegelian synthesis as meaning to sacrifice rationality or the validity of reason or even the logical law of non-contradiction. Hegel's proposals were not of that sort at all. He did not berate logical consistency. In fact, he forcefully advocated what's called a coherence view of the truth. What Hegel deemed inadequate was finite man's conceptualizing of reality and giving it rational expression. Let me say that again. I think it's good for you to get it in your notes. What Hegel deemed inadequate at any particular point is finite man's conceptualizing of reality and giving it rational expression. And so in the preface to his book, Phenomenology of Mind, Hegel said, and I quote, "The truth is the whole," W-H-O-L-E. "The truth is the whole. Therefore, any set of propositions which falls short of being a complete system covering the whole of reality, will, due to its incompletion, generate its own inadequacies and contradictions. The categories that we use, the concepts that we use, the universals that are used to explain our experience, according to Hegel, these categories in our logical thinking are not definitive. They're only tentative. They're only provisional. Okay? You can understand someone saying that. What do you know about atomic theory today? Now, any of you who are up on atomic theory, if you were to talk about electron clouds and so forth, you have to understand that somebody way back when the, you know, the Bohr model of the atom was reigning in scientific thinking, wouldn't even know what you're talking about. And yet you're talking about the same thing. It's just that it's been refined and refined and refined. And so the concept of the atom, which was oversimple, has, you know, come through negation and synthesis to be developed into a higher level of consciousness and a more adequate concept. And so between the thesis and its antithesis, Hegel said there's a dynamic tension because both positions contain something rational in them, and yet both positions are somehow inadequate. And the whole point, listen, the whole point of coming to synthetic resolution of that tension is not to renounce logical consistency, but to preserve what is logical in both the positions and to chop off what is inadequate, what is illogical and indeterminate from them. And so it turns out that Hegel's dialectic, although I disagree with it, we have to portray it accurately, Hegel's dialectic is not, as Schaeffer said, a way of destroying rationality, it's a way of preserving rationality. All contradictions will be reconciled, and all falsity, all indeterminateness, removed in the dialectical unfolding of our thinking, but only when our system of thought is complete. Of course, this is the interesting kicker for Hegel. When our system of thought is complete, it will have developed into a complete unity with the object of thought, or reality itself. So all reality will be complete and have worked out historically when our system of thought is complete as well. But that's another story. Hegel's dialectic method does not view the world as a collection of externally related and discrete things. It rather encourages us to understand reality as continuous. Everything's related to everything else, and it's part of an evolving process. And so his philosophy warns us against taking any given state of the developmental process in thought or in historical unfolding as somehow fully adequate. Such a stage is not wholly mistaken, but it's nevertheless a misleading representation of what will ultimately develop from it. If you were to look at a tadpole, would you be able to explain a frog? Be careful. The answer is yes and no. You can't explain a frog without explaining a tadpole. But on the other hand, obviously, the fully developed reality doesn't bear a real great resemblance to the earlier version of it. Okay? And so Hegel's saying, be careful when you conceptualize your tadpole thinking. But in the end, it's going to be a frog that you end up with. And so it's not that he gives up rationality. He wants to chasten us and help us to see that the way we use our concepts is not concrete and universal enough. We don't have concrete universals. We need to keep working toward that. And the only way we'll finally reach that ultimate rationality is when we have the whole of the truth in our conceptualization. And as I said, at that point, we'll have the whole of reality. It'll be identical with our thinking. Of course, it won't be our thinking when it's the whole of reality, will it? It will be absolute spirit, unqualified, universal spirit at that point. All right. Any questions about what Hegel is trying to accomplish through the dialectic and how Schaeffer has sabotaged? I mean, he's got part of it right. See, there's a partial one-sided truth there. Hegel was more in the direction of the romantic understanding that the old Enlightenment reason was inadequate, but Schaeffer is wrong to think that Hegel is throwing out rationality itself. Question? Yes. Oh, yes, yes. In fact, elaborate outworking of things. In yesterday's lecture, I mentioned the only thing he finally accomplished or got finished before he died was the logic. But Hegel, in a sense, considered the proof of his theory the outworking of his theory, which was a brilliant move because given the nature of what he's claiming, that would have to be true, right? The only proof that this is true is that it can finally make adequate explanations for everything and show the genetic dialectic evolution of them. Yes. Gone. That's why this is called the monism of absolute spirit. Individuality is on its way out. What happened to the Bohr model of the atom? Did the atom change? Yes. No. There's truth in both of those ideas that the atom didn't change. I mean, how could it change? It's got to be the same. And yet, it's not really the same object of thought. So individuality is going to have the same fate as the Bohr model of the atom, if you will. Okay, let's talk about this system of triads. You've been very patient. I think you've been understanding pretty much what I've been saying, but it's been a strain because we don't tend to think this way, but you've been following up to this point. I'm going to say something that's a little more complicated, so take a deep breath. All of this triadic dialectical movement, you have to understand, is a full system of triads. So every triad, every member of a triad, you know what I mean by a triad? Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Well, every member of that triad itself has a sub-triad, and every member of that sub-triad has a sub-sub-triad. This is wild. But of course, it would have to be that way given Hegel's grand plan for everything to be encompassed. I mean, all of nature, all of reality has got to somehow be brought into concrete, conceptual, rational form. And therefore, if you're going to do this in terms of dialectical reasoning, there's going to be a lot of triads you've got to go through. Every reconciling synthesis, as I told you yesterday, is itself contradicted by another synthesis in a different area of triadic thinking. And so these syntheses which contradict each other need to be resolved at a higher level. And then, to make it even worse, groups of triads and syntheses contradict other groups of triads and syntheses, and those groups of triads need to be resolved at a higher level of triads as well. So, I don't know, when you were children, did you ever get, you know, for your birthday or Christmas, one of these toys where you have a box inside a box inside a box inside a box, or a ball inside of a ball, or whatever it is? Are you deprived or something? You nod your heads. You know what I'm talking about? Okay, okay. So you understood Hegel when you were children. You see, you have triads within triads within triads. There you go. Or if you will, you have a hierarchy of triads, and eventually we're going to get to the place where everything's worked out into a final concrete universal that is the unqualified truth. All truth is eventually synthesized into an all-inclusive resolution, an all-inclusive unity. And probably the most fun in this morning's lecture is going to be in the next few minutes when Dr. Bonson illustrates for you Hegel's dialectical reasoning. Now, I want to, in a sense, bracket off what I'm doing in this illustration stuff, because some of you are going to finally just say, forget it. You're going to be listening to this and say, what on earth is he talking about? I hope none of you do, but my guess is some of you are just going to get lazy and say, I'm not going to work that hard, I'm not going to think about it. But if that happens to you, I don't want you to think somehow you've zoned out and lost the whole lecture. Because what you've understood up to this point, you still understand. It's just I'm going to try to illustrate how abstruse and difficult this triadic thinking, this dialectical reasoning of Hegel can be. Now, if it's boxes within boxes within boxes, triads within triads within triads, I can't illustrate by giving all of it. I'm going to have to pick. But I have picked, I followed W.T. Jones here, who, as I've already told you, is kind of the center core of my presentation of these lectures. I followed him in three illustrations of this triadic thinking. The most basic one, the original triad. And then we're going to talk about the main triad, that is the most important one along the way, and then the ultimate triad. So at least you'll get to sample the beginning, the middle, and the end of this long dialectical process, according to Hegel. Okay, let's take a look at the first baseline dialectic for Hegel. This is following his discussion in the book Logic. And that baseline triad is being, nothing, which is resolved into becoming. Being, nothing, and becoming. I told you yesterday philosophy requires you to think in abstract terms. And this seems very abstract. Being and nothing and becoming. We're not talking about anything concrete. Anything that's blue or red or big or small or fast or slow or hot or cold or, you know, here or there. We're just talking about being and nothing and becoming. What is the most basic concept? The most basic concept. If you're going to reason, what is the bottom line, most fundamental thing you can say about anything? That it exists. That is the lowest level and the most vague, elementary thing that you can say about anything. That it is. It has being. It is. See, that wasn't so hard, was it? Here is the broadest, most basic, and vaguest of all concepts, existence, being. However, that bare claim of existence, to simply say something is so minimal, that you're really saying nothing at all when you say that it is. That is, you're saying nothing determinative about it. All right, if I put up here on the board, X is. And that's the lowest level thing. But now what have I told you about X? What have I told you about X? Thank you. Nothing determinative at all, right? There you go. Existence has within it the seeds of its own disillusion. I say it is, but that's so low level, so vague, that I've not told you anything. I've told you nothing. So have I told you something, or have I told you nothing? It's both. X is as well as saying nothing at all. So you have being, and you have nothing standing over against one another. Now how can you resolve that? How can we save rationality? So the world is not being, the world is not nothing, both of those are inadequate ways of putting it. The world must be viewed in a becoming mode, a developmental mode. Because when things are becoming, they have an isness about them, an existence about them, but on the same hand, they have a notness about them, a nothingness about them. They pass into one another. So the larger whole of becoming, that is the more adequate concept of becoming, incorporates is and nothing within itself. So that's his baseline triad, my first illustration of dialectical thinking. You follow that, right? Now, I want to say, if you follow it, good, I follow it, I understand. But I also, as a philosopher, want to say that's absolute garbage thinking. I mean, it's so full of puns and equivocations that I don't find it adequate at all. But now, what would Hegel say to this criticism? Just as an aside here. Basically, I'm saying, this is so imprecise, this is so ambiguous, this being and nothing and so forth, that it's really worthless. Hegel would say, but look at the concept of reason that you're utilizing. Oversimple. You're looking for precision and so forth. See, I've got to loosen up and I've got to become more adequate to the wholeness of reality. The not nothings itself. The not nothings itself. There are philosophers who are really impressed with the profundity of that statement. The not nothings itself. That is, the negation negates itself. There are men, I trust that they are men, there are human beings that are impressed with that, and there are others who just say, I've got better things to do. I don't know quite how to resolve all that for you, but Hegel was impressed by it. He considered that a profound insight. Dr. Bahnsen is kind of so-so. The not-nothings itself. To me, and I could be wrong, I don't want to pretend that I can lord it over Hegel, but to me, the not-nothings itself and being nothing are resolved into becoming are kind of like interesting word games. You know, I mean, I have to teach this, and I'm... Obviously, I have not totally thrown Hegel out, because there are people who did write utter nonsense in the 19th century, and we're not even going to mention them. So I am bothering to mention Hegel, and I'm trying. I've taken it as a challenge. I want to do, I hope, a faithful and godly job of teaching you. So I've taken it as a challenge to try to make this somehow intelligible to you. Okay? So I can play the game, if you will. The word games and so forth. When all is said and done, when I get done, I don't go home at night and say, boy, that was really profound, that stuff. I say, well, that was kind of a game you play with words and you just kind of learn to think this way. There are really two different temperaments. And mine is more geared toward the analytical rather than the synthetic. And I don't find what Hegel's saying here all that helpful. But many people think this is quite profound. And I hope you at least understand what he's getting at when he says being generates nothing and the two are resolved in becoming. Any questions? Yes. The most elementary triad. You don't end with the triad. You end with a concrete universal.
Well, the complete sentence.
That's right.
If I may. How can you start with one? Where do all these other triads come from if there's only one start with?
Well, what did we? That's why I you have to pay attention to the genius of Dr. Bahnsen's teaching. The first thing I taught you was about the principle of negation this morning. Remember, every truth generates its own dissolution, and so if you begin with one, now you have a negation, and it's kind of like they're off and running now, because now that you've got that, then this truth has its negation in it, and you know, you have to kind of watch all these, you know. Action-reaction type of things. Kind of think of it as you know, a set of dominoes that are laid out, you know, across a huge floor. It only one domino starts the process, right? But once that begins and all these chain reactions are going, and Hegel said, okay, the first thing is. That's the most basic thing, is existence. But if that's all you have, you've got nothing. Uh-oh, now we've got two things, being and nothing. Which is it? That's resolved in becoming. And now all of the chain reaction is off and running, and eventually it's going to come together. I mean, in one sense, it's a really grand system because it's all going to come together in absolute spirit eventually in the final synthesis where being, the reality, and thought are one and the same. Well, let me give you a second illustration of dialectical thinking here, which is really the main triad within the huge complex system of Hegel here, and that's the triad of being, essence, and notion. Being represents the naive, immediate way of encountering experience. But if we were to be more critical, our way of encountering experience, realizing that things are not always the way they appear at face value, the more critical mindset thinks in terms of essence, that is, distinguishes between what a thing really is and how it appears to some mind. And so naive experience just gives us being as it is. But we know, if we're more critical, that things are not always the way they appear. And that means our thinking about what's out there is mediated because we're using distinctions, concepts. Now, how do you reconcile being and essence then? Essence means saying that things as they really are is different from the way they appear. They're reconciled in what Hegel called notion, today translated concept, a synthesis of being uncritically certain and dogmatically doubting. Okay, the being approach doesn't draw any distinctions. And so in that sense, it's uncritical, and it's just absolutely certain. But the essence approach, which draws distinctions, can lead to dogmatic doubt, so that we never know for sure if we've ever reached reality, because things are not always the way they appear. So how do you reconcile the naivete, the uncritical being approach to consciousness, and the essence approach that draws these distinctions? Well, in what he called notion or concept. The more we study things that seem to differ, the more they become part and parcel of one another. Let's say you're studying cause and effect. Okay, what causes the blossom on the tree? Where you say the bud causes the blossom. But you know, the more you study that, you realize the bud and the blossom have an interrelationship. It's not like one is cause and one is effect. They're really one reality. They're connected to each other. They're not distinct at all. And so there's a reciprocal relationship between bud and blossom. Blossom is the bud developed. Bud is the blossom in its undeveloped form. So you see how becoming has entered into to help us see that what was cause and what was effect is really a reciprocal kind of relationship. I know this one's a little bit tougher, but it's not altogether impossible to understand. Let's try the last one, the final triad. The ultimate, final, all-inclusive triad for reality, according to Hegel, is idea, nature, and spirit. Idea, which has as its negation nature, and these are resolved, synthesized into spirit or mind. Idea and nature are at once the same and yet different from each other. Spirit, mind, becomes their synthesis. As an aside, that's why Hegel didn't mind having philosophers, in a sense, lorded over scientists. Because in the end, if mind or spirit is the synthesis of idea and nature,
those who study nature are going to have to give way to those who are closer to idea, because spirit is the final resolution of them. Anyway, back to the main thought. Thinking, when taken as idea, has an object that's other than thought. We all understand this. When we think about something. And so thinking projects an object which is other than thinking. Those objects of thought Hegel called nature. Okay? So nature is the object of idea. We have ideas about nature. We think about nature. And that means there's a conflict between the knower, using idea, and the known, which we call nature. At a higher level of consciousness, however, thought and the objects of thought, knower and what the knower knows, are identical while simultaneously being distinct, but they are identical. A minute ago I talked about the bud and the blossom being reciprocally related. Well, kind of put it in that category. The knower and what the knower knows are really reciprocally related. What the knower knows defines the knower's identity, and yet the way in which the knower knows it defines the object's identity. Spirit is the resolution of this conflict of idea and nature. It is thought knowing itself. However, it is thought knowing itself not as thought, but as thought of the object. I've got to say this again. It takes a while. Maybe it has to be 1:15 in the morning before it, you know, the coin drops. But, and you kind of go, wow. That's profound. Thought knowing itself. Okay, so thought thinking about thought. However, not thinking about thought simply as thinking, but thinking of itself as thinking of the object. And so it's kind of like you finally fold in upon yourself and your thinking. It's thought thinking about thought, but it's not just thought that's out there, it's thought of the I'm thinking of myself as thinking of an object. But what the object is that I'm thinking of is my thinking. And so the circle's complete. Wow. I took my medicine this morning. That helped. I think I've got this. You all with me? It's thought, thinking of itself as an object. And so now I've transcended the distinction between idea and nature, because the object is the thinking of the object. And the thinking is the thinking of the object that's thinking of itself. And so now thought and object are the same. Wow! That's absolute spirit. That's unqualified self-consciousness at its highest level. Remember, what I think about is actually part of what I am. That is, the way things appear to me is part of my identity. Not only that, the objects that I think about are not isolated and unaffected, some kind of brute facts within nature. So my thinking of myself as thinking of myself, my thinking of myself as an object that's thinking of the object as thinking, transcends the distinction between thinking and object. And so the object, let me go back to the board here, the object, nature, this is me thinking here, as an object, has now been transcended, because I'm not just an object thinking, I mean an object of thinking, I am the thinking that thinks about that object. So now I'm back to idea. But it's when, if you look at the idea side of things, my thinking is not simply of an object out there, because I'm thinking of what I actually am, the thinking subject. And so thinking and the object of thinking have really become the same thing here. And I do think Hegel is correct about this. I have now come to understand this. All jokes aside, I think he's right. when you think about yourself as thinking about yourself, then the object and what you're thinking about are the same. I agree with that. And I also think that is completely trivial. I didn't say that. I mean, I am sure you would laugh at that, but I didn't say it to get a laugh. You need to realize that to the degree you can understand what Hegel's saying, and I do now understand that, okay? When I think about myself as the object that is thinking about myself, I have transcended the distinction between the thinker and what is thought about. I agree with that. But after I get there, again, maybe this is just my, you know, temperament, I say, so? It just seems to me so unenlightened and so unimportant that I call it trivial. But many people, Hegel obviously, saw this as very profound. Now, we've gotten to the place where we see that absolute spirit is the universal unqualified truth. We need to understand that there is a triad within spirit, however. There is subjective spirit that we would today call a psychological study, that is spirit thinking from the introspective side of things. And there's objective spirit that considers external relations with other minds, not objects, dead objects, things in themselves, but other objects.